Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Berkman Center and to our regular weekly lunch series. My name is Ethan Zuckerman. I'm a research fellow here at the center. Before I introduce David Sasaki, my dear friend and our prestigious and enlightening speaker for the day, we've got certain Berkman procedures that we have to go through. The first one is to warn you that these luncheon series are broadcast through every possible media we can figure out. Not only is this being webcast via the cameras around the room, not only is it being streamed into Second Life, I have it on good authority that there's a small village in Japan where frame by frame this is being transcribed onto manga comics. So anything you say in this room is likely to be broadcast to some large percentage of the world, so choose your words accordingly. With that in mind, the first thing we always do here is we introduce everyone in the room so that the speaker knows who they're talking to and we all know who each other is. This is helpful because the format for these talks is generally a talk for about 25 or 30 minutes, followed by what is usually lively and spirited discussion. So we'll start by introducing ourselves. As I said, I'm Ethan. I'm a fellow here. To my right.
I'm David Senge. I'm an undergrad, a junior from Sierra Leone.
David Larshaw, Berkman staff.
Hey, Harry. Well, welcome everybody. Thanks for being with us. I just want to take a moment or two to introduce our speaker before I hand over the microphone to David. Who here knows what Global Voices is, the Global Voices Project? Show of hands, please. Okay, so more or less everybody, so I don't really need to go into this. Global Voices is a project that is heading towards its fourth anniversary. And David Sasaki is someone who's been with us literally from day one of this project, the first meeting we had at Harvard to discuss this effort to build an international news site and to do it through a combination of professional and volunteer work to build it. David has taken on a very special role within Global Voices, which he's going to be talking about today. And I should explain that when we talk about Global Voices, we generally make analogies in terms of either bars or parties. And there's sort of good reasons for this, because generally speaking, when you're trying to get hundreds of people from around the world to cooperate on something, it's much, much better to use the metaphor of a party than to say the metaphor of a factory. But we were talking in Budapest at our annual meeting a couple of months ago, and David came up with a couple of analogies that were very, very helpful. He described what one of our colleagues does, a gentleman named Sami Ben Garbia, who runs Global Voices Advocacy Unit, as the guy who sort of shows up at the bar and talks to the bouncer and sort of says, no, you got to let these guys in. You know, you got to let these people be involved with the internet. You can't censor the net in their countries. You got to give them access to the tools of speech. So Sami is the guy who actually goes and sort of talks down the bouncer. And the good news is that I've actually seen Sami talk down a bouncer in Turkish, which isn't even a language he speaks, and he's very successful at it. David, by extension in the same analogy, described himself as the crazy guy who shows up at the bar with a bus full of people that no one's ever met anywhere before from around the world and says, hey, I brought some friends, and brings them into the party. And that's precisely what David's work has been about over the last 2 years. It's been about trying to massively expand the circle of people who are involved with what we refer to as citizen media, this act of blogging around the world. And what David is really doing, in the context that I sort of want to put on this, because I don't know to what extent David's going to brag about this work, but I think David is probably testing the very hardest statement we can make about citizen media, which is that things like blogs, like video casting, like podcasting, like sharing photographs, actually can give voice to virtually anyone, anywhere in the world. And this tends to be sort of accepted as our sort of kumbaya vision of the internet, but David's actually testing it by showing up in some of the least connected corners of the world and giving people a chance to get online. In doing this, he's getting a great deal of love and respect for this work, most notably made it to the finals of the Best of the Blog Awards. This is an international blogging competition run by Deutsche Welle, and Rising Voices, David's project, is currently nominated as one of the 8 finalists for the best blog in the world. And I hope that if you get nothing else out of this, you will immediately get online and show him your love by voting for him. But I'm going to hand the microphone over to my friend and colleague, David Sasaki. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Ethan. We actually tested the party metaphor and we made it a reality the final day of Budapest, of the summit. And we had every participant who was there. I did bring a small bus of people from around. And we had every participant there bring a bottle of alcohol from their country. And it was messy. Sammy is very good at talking down the bouncers. And I think it would be a good strategy to do here at the Berkman Center. So I propose that on Tuesday luncheons, everyone bring a bottle of something. Next time I come here, I think that would be nice. In fall of 2004, I was living in San Diego, which is behind me. Actually, I want to get up real quick. I apologize for the microphone. One thing that about San Diego and its geographic features is that the neighborhoods are very much split up by bays, lagoons, rivers, mesas, huge hills, very deep valleys and gorges. And so in San Diego, you have, they call it a city of neighborhoods because I think this is the trendy thing to do in urban planning magazines, but it's really a city of cities. I mean, there are about 12 different cities in San Diego that just don't even talk to each other. They, you know, someone living in La Jolla, on the left-hand side of La Jolla Mesa, for example, will have never been to Lemon Grove, even though it's only about 20 miles away, and Lemon Grove is beautiful and has the best barbecue ribs in all of San Diego, but it's very much separate. And this is how human civilization, I think, has organized itself pretty much forever. So back in 2004, when Sphere actually was an applicable word for the blogging community, there were about 20 of us with blogs in San Diego, and two of us wanted to have this project. We thought, you know, it'd be so cool if we could get young people living in all these different neighborhoods to each have their own community blogs and journals, and then they could describe what their communities are like to other young people around there. This was a time when blogging was such a small scene and such a strong community that one person at a conference called BloggerCon could actually get this entire community to sing along, sing national anthems and folk songs, and everyone would stand up and kind of belt out these things. I remember being in San Diego and riding my bike. I would go on afternoon bike rides all the time. And I remember listening to these voices and wanting to meet these people and feeling like I'd already met these people. I remember Rebecca was my homegirl. This is Rebecca McKinnon, who the co-founder of Global Voices, along with Ethan. She was my homegirl from the very beginning, because every time that there was a conference like BloggerCon or anything like that, and I remember these conferences well. I was listening to all the podcasts, and it was always, RSS 1 is better. No, Adam is better. No, RSS 2 is better. And the conversation would kind of go on like this for panel after panel and session after session, and Rebecca always made the point, well, who's the one who's going to benefit from all of these technologies? Like, how are they actually being used? Someone else who I really wanted to meet for a long time was...
I want to know where you got that photo. That photo is generally tightly controlled in its distribution.
Yeah. That was off the Benjamin Franklin family tree genetic type thing. So I was thinking about this project of how to get young people in different communities in San Diego, how to get them all blogging together and how to train them and how to get them involved. So who to reach out to, the teachers or the PTA or, I mean, how would you do this? I started listening to some podcasts that Ethan was putting on. There were some conversations when Ethan would talk on a few panels with Joey, and Ethan was talking about how to do the same type of project, but not in the city of San Diego, but in the entire world. So he was noticing that there were bloggers in Malaysia and there were bloggers in China, and why aren't they talking with each other? Why is there this kind of separation? Why are these gorges and mesas and rivers in a medium where there is no geography, where you're just hyper-click, hyperlink away from anyone, everyone? So I somehow managed to convince my partner on this project to send me to a conference called the Internet and Society 2004 conference. This was after Howard Dean screamed, so all of the techno-utopianists who said, bloggers are going to change the world, bloggers are going to control the politics. It was a very depressing conference for all of us. But there was a track called Global Voices. I was going to this because I wanted to learn more about how to outreach to kids, to get them involved in the San Diego Blogging Project. Global Voices just happened to be a much cooler group of people, so I skipped out the track that I was going to go to, and I checked out this conversation. I was able to convince my partner to fly me out to the conference, which was fantastic, but I was not able to convince him that my accommodation should be paid for. So I flew into Boston, I flew into Logan Airport, and I got in around 6 o'clock in the evening, and I went down to the Harvard Co-op bookstore, and I saw some speakers there, and I was flipping around the books, and I was like, this is so cool, I'm in Cambridge, it's freezing, and I have no place to stay tonight. So I took the bus back to Logan Airport, and that was pretty much me for the rest of the night. There was a Salvadorian woman, a middle-aged Salvadorian woman, who had an industrial-strength vacuum cleaner, and every 30 minutes, while I was trying to sleep in Logan Airport, she would come right up next to me and be, and just when I was falling asleep, there'd be this just terrible noise in my ear. So I did not sleep much the night before the Internet and Society 2004 conference, and I was thinking, this woman is not my friend. Like, I have some problems. Why is she coming around with this vacuum cleaner? Then I started thinking, around 4:45, after I still had not slept at all, you know, she does this every single night of the week, at least 5 nights a week. I mean, this is her job. She goes around and she cleans up Terminal 2 and vacuums over and over the same carpet that's not even dirty, and that's what she's hired to do. And I was thinking, I love airports. I love going around and seeing people in airports and people from everywhere. She probably has so many great stories. And she's probably really desperate to talk. She must be bored out of her freaking mind vacuum cleaning throughout the night. And why don't I just say, hey, you know, you want to talk? Why didn't we just have a conversation right there? And it's because it goes against social norms. You know, here I am, like, the well-intentioned white guy going to a conference about blogging and internet, and she's working at an international airport, and she's cleaning. And there's just not a lot, there's no easy way for us to fall into conversation. I can't, you know, just bring up something, hey, what model vacuum cleaner is that? It's not going to work. The next day, I went to the conference. I think Saturday morning is when they had the Global Voices track, and my mind was completely blown. There were bloggers, there were at least 20 or 30 of us from all over the world. There were bloggers from Iraq. This is, I think, at the beginning of the Iraq War, is that right? The invasion?
Shortly after it. Yeah, it was about 2 years in, but Iraqi blogging had become a very big deal.
And there were military bloggers who were also in Iraq, and there were bloggers from Malaysia. There was a blogger who went by the name Hoder, who was from Iran, and he had this wonderful metaphor of that blogs can be they can be windows into societies, they can be cafes where people have exchanges and talk, they can be bridges between society, and that's where this concept of the bridge blogger came up. And that's what Global Voices really became dependent on, these bridge blogging figures, these figures in between two societies. If you look through the list of Global Voices authors, you'll find that a lot of them are living in the diaspora. So they are from one country, but they're living somewhere else. And they're really passionate about blogging and about writing about their culture because it's a connection back home. All of this just blew my mind. But I was there for the San Diego Blogging Project, for these youth to be involved and become these community reporters. And so the whole time I was at the conference, when I wasn't just being blown away by Global Voices, I was talking to people about Atom versus RSS and Drupal versus Civic Space versus WordPress versus all of this technology stuff, which turned out to be a complete waste of time because, meanwhile, while I was here and throughout the winter and throughout the next spring, there was another website that was becoming very, very popular called MySpace.com. And that was my first real lesson in citizen media outreach, is that the first thing you have to do is pay attention to what people are actually doing. In this case, it was the youth of San Diego, rather than just talking to the geeks and trying to find out what's the best technology. So you talk to the users, I don't even like that word, you talk to the people that you're trying to work with first. And our project could have been really successful if we had tried to build it on top of MySpace, because they already had a platform. They already had a good tool. We weren't tapping into it. We weren't speaking their language. We didn't know their design aesthetic, for sure. This MySpace page, by the way, is like all animated GIFs. the gifts. So the little, the walking guys and dancing guys, they're, it's the craziest thing I've ever seen. The other thing is that during this time in MySpace, everyone was 102 years old, because if you were under, I think you had to be 18 years old, and if you were under 18, you had to be 100 or something. My second failure in citizen media outreach, in trying to get new people blogging who weren't blogging before, and trying to expand the conversation that was taking place in the blogosphere beyond just technology and gadgets and technical specifications, came from Rebecca. This was at BloggerCon 3. She had this idea of Blogger Core. It wasn't only her idea. I mean, there was a whole conversation that this popped up. And she said, I mean, she just was really focused, especially this entire year, of saying, blogging's great. It's fantastic that every 20-something in San Francisco is blogging about, you know, how they had such a great job during the internet boom, and then how they lost it in the bust, and they have all this time on their hands. But there are all these NGOs all around the world. She was a reporter for CNN for a long time, so she was involved in really hard stories. And she knew the voices that she would go out and interview, but they didn't have the capacity to make their own voices heard, even though they were the ones who would really benefit from blogging the most. So Blogger Core, thanks to the support of geeks and everything, there was a website, there was a domain, it was a Drupal platform, it had trackbacks, it had RSS, it had all of these fancy specifications. This is a post that I wrote. I met a man who had lived in Zimbabwe for about a year. He was in Afghanistan when I wrote this, and he wanted to do a blogging platform for Zimbabwe to get to blog about news stories that were happening in Zimbabwe so that you could add some editorial context to what the government papers and the mainstream media in Zimbabwe was saying. I thought that that was pretty cool. It was one of the first hits if you search for Zimbabwe blog. So I said, okay, you need some help. You need some people who can help you blog, who can, you know, get some more content up on the page, who can search for good news stories and put them up there so that your volunteers can come up. I put it on. Nobody said anything. So about a month later, Blogger Core had a single success story, and it had about 30 kind of proposals that people put up there. And there was only one success story. So why was there only one success story, and what happened to make that one successful? It turned out it was a NGO, a nonprofit in Kentucky called the Grandparent Coalition. I'm trying to get through all of this really quick because I heard that lecturing is not cool at the Berkman Luncheon, and the conversation's cool. So we're gonna have 5 more minutes,
it's gonna
and then
be
I'm
cool.
gonna shut up, and then we're just gonna talk about all of this. This is a friend of mine who is a Kentucky blogger, and he taught the Grandparent Coalition how to blog. This became their blog. They wrote some great things. And this was the only one on Blogger Core that became successful. And the other ones didn't. And I was trying to think, I wrote a long post, why wasn't Blogger Core a successful mission? You know, there was so much excitement about it when it first happened. There were 50 people saying that they would get behind it. And yet, we only taught one nonprofit how to blog. And I think that the answer is just that we were not having enough fun. We didn't write messages to each other. We didn't have any parties. There wasn't nearly enough alcohol involved. We just had very serious emails about activist issues and about nonprofits and about all of this very serious stuff. And there was hardly any smiling going on at all. So the fact that this became the blog that was done, it was through a friend of mine who I spent a lot of time just joking around with. So we had this connection. There was a social element involved. It was fun. And so he wanted to get involved. That was the number one thing that I learned with Rising Voices. And I'll get into the start of Rising Voices a little bit later, but these are some pictures from some of the Rising Voices projects where we teach people. There's a project in Calcutta, India there. Two pictures from a small town right outside of Medellin, Colombia. And then also in Antananarivo, Madagascar, some people too. And you'll see they have their arms around each other all the time. They're smiling, they're laughing. We have fun first, and then after we have fun, we start blogging about it and we start talking about technology. And that was the biggest lesson. When Clay Shirky, he wrote a book recently, Here Comes Everybody. And when he talks about why Howard Forums is the most successful online forum when it comes to mobile phones, if you want to learn something about a mobile phone device, this is where you go. It's obviously not the best, most well-designed thing. It's kind of an ugly site. But it's this forum that's the most popular and is the secret and the magic to the success of Howard Forums. It's called The Lounge. And this is not where you talk about cell phones. It's where you talk about exercise and nutrition, politics, your pets, because there are not enough places to talk about pets online, sports. You can see, I put this up recently, Joe the Plumber Warns America. You know, it's a place where you can just talk and do what you would do around a coffee table, It just happens to be about people who are all passionate about mobile phones. All of this has me going back to 2004 now, when I'm thinking about all of these issues about what makes a successful outreach project. How do you train people to be blogging? And I was thinking about this Salvadorian woman who I just did not have the courage to talk to. And I was thinking, what is something, even though Global Voices had been going on now for 3 years and had become hugely successful, and we're cited in mainstream media articles every single week, almost every day now, almost all of the bloggers that you see on Global Voices come from middle to upper class families. Most of them live in urban communities. Most of them are well-educated, are well-traveled, are cosmopolitans, are urbanites. You don't see many middle-aged women immigrants who work at airports. You just don't see many blogs written by those people. Thanks to Ethan's amazing grant writing skills, thanks to the support of the Knight Foundation, a year and a half ago we had actual resources. So we had an allotment of money, and we could get really serious about it. We also had a good brand, which was Global Voices. We were very well recognized. People knew who we were. We had a huge community of support. We had bloggers based in almost every single country who could write about what we were doing and encourage us. And we had a huge network, which was the most important thing, who could introduce us to people who own ISPs, to people who work in newspapers. This became Rising Voices. So as director of outreach, this is the project that I quote unquote run, but really that's just writing a lot of emails back and forth and encouraging people to do good stuff. The model is that every 6 months there's a grant competition. It's a micro grant competition. So we give out 5 micro grants of $5,000 or less to 5 different projects that want to use participatory or citizen media tools like blogs, podcasts, video blogs, to make underrepresented communities represented online. So if there's some community where you just don't see many bloggers, when you Google for this community, and rather than seeing blog posts like we see for almost anything else you Google, you just see foreign correspondent articles or nothing at all. Those are the communities that you'll be reading about on Rising Voices. I'm going to, while I talk, I'll quickly play. Oops. How do I play this?
Do you have audio on it?
Oh, yeah, there's some. Yeah. Yeah.
Something just freaked out for a second.
It's not going to go through. Okay, I'm going to pull this down because I do want to show one quick video to give you an example, because I think it'd be terrible if I was talking the entire time rather than some of the people that have been trained how to do this stuff and are just incredibly talented.
You just on the wrong monitor?
Now I'm on the wrong monitor, but I'm going to pull it up and is there a zebra on there?
Yeah. That's good looking.
That's not. Let's see. So I can put this over here.
There we go.
And then. Okay, some volume. So the guy who's singing the song right now is one of the bloggers. His name is Sibonello. This is Kwamashu. It's a township that's right outside of Durban in South Africa. It's about 20 miles away, and there's this multi-art center there. And there are about 20 young performing artists who get scholarships to learn how to be. They have a one-year kind of internship. They're all from the local township. And so basically, I was teaching them how to blog, and then we handed over some digital cameras, and this is the movie that they came up with.
This place is called Kwa happening. This is how our center.
So it goes on for about 3 more minutes, and I hope that you go to the website, rising.globalvoicesonline.org, because this is just one of 16 projects. Almost all of the projects have videos up that are like that one. And you meet the people in the videos, I think is pretty powerful to then be able to go meet, to then see the blogs that they write on. This morning I was actually reviewing their blogs, and Gugu, who is the young woman who has the shaved head, there's a good thing and there's a bad thing. She got invited to Paris.
No. Why is it working now?
She got invited to Paris to take part in this performing arts piece, which is really fantastic. And I told her, well, you know, you should blog about it, and then some people in Paris will be able to find out about it. And I'm sure people in the Global Voices community. So she taps into this community. She taps into the social capital that's there, and she's probably going to get a lot of support when she does that in France. She also wrote another blog post, which said that her brother died a couple days ago. And it was tough for me because I had just met her a couple weeks before, and she's obviously a very dynamic young woman, and she's very sweet. But I thought that she just learned how to blog about a month ago, and she already feels comfortable sharing this, and she wanted to put that out there. So you never know what people are going to use the blogs for. But she got a lot of support from her friends when she wrote that, so it was good. So we... Part of the model is that when people win the grants, then local citizen media experts, mostly local bloggers, will go out to the communities, or if they live around there, they will do the training, which is the best way to do it. Because if you're going to train a community how to blog, you want someone who's there. And we have this great idea that, well, so many amazing things are happening in some of these communities where the projects take place. For example, Repacted, which is in Nakuru, Kenya, there was this huge violent post-election crisis that took place in mostly in January of this year, and a lot of the refugees went to Nakuru. So there's a big refugee camp there, and we thought that that's what they would blog about. So one of their bloggers got trained, and his name's Lawrence, and he says, "I am Lawrence, I love women with big ass." Which is not exactly what we thought would be his first blog post, but if I've learned anything in Rising Voices, it's to not force people to write about a certain topic, because if you teach someone to blog and say, like, okay, now go write about HIV and AIDS, or about refugees or some NGO-y type topic, they're going to absolutely hate it, and it's not going to be a fun thing. After Lawrence and I discussed that first blog post for a little while, he moved on. We had a little bit of an exchange. He moved on and he started talking about how he uses puppets in theater productions around Nakuru to educate people about HIV and TB. And he also has shot a video now of that puppetry, and he's going to put that up online pretty soon. So I think it was really good that he got started, that he made it feel like it was his space first. and now he feels comfortable using it for whatever he wants. And a lot of times people ask me, you know, especially some of my friends, they're like, why are you teaching more people how to blog? Because we need less blogs, less information, less stuff to read about every single day when we turn our computers on. I think that's true to a certain degree, actually. But I think part of it, I mean, we don't teach young people how to write so that they can all become novelists, you know? It's a skill that comes in handy at certain times. And so when you teach someone the skill and you teach them the literacy, and so when a spark of inspiration happens, or when they witness something that's just incredible that deserves to be put down on paper and deserves to enter history, it should. And this was an example. This is a blog post by Sadi. His real name is DeNaber. And he talked about what it was like to live, to grow up in his community outside of Medellin when there was a lot of violence, when there was a lot of warfare between the army and the guerrillas. It's a really, really powerful piece. I put the URL down there in case you want to read it. It's pretty long, but it's worthwhile if you're interested in Colombia or even if you're not. So to teach him, he only writes about one blog post a month, but the fact that he was able to put this one article up, that it will exist for his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren and anyone who wants to know about this community. And the fact that when you now Google for La Loma Medellin, rather than seeing all of these war reports written by foreign correspondents, the first thing that comes up is their project blog. So they are the ones who are able to define, as far as Google goes, because that's how we find out about information now, what their community is like, what they have to say about it, what are the stories that they want to be out there. There are now 16 projects in 15 countries. Over 400 new bloggers have been trained in more than 20 communities. Quite a few of them in some of the projects have become internationally known. They've gotten written about in major mainstream media outlets. They get invited to big conferences. It's been really successful because it's a tight-knit community, and because some people from some of these projects visit other people from other these projects, and they're friends, and they like each other, and it's kind of the same thing with the Howard Forums, that there is this community first, there's the friendship, and then there's the documentation and the writing and the storytelling that comes in after that. Something else has been happening in the past year and a half of Global Voices. So it's been just about exactly 18 months since we first started now, and I would say that it's been a very successful project, especially compared to the first two that I tried to get involved with Blogger Corps and the San Diego youth blogging one. Something else has been happening is that our mailing list, we started with about 80 people who were mostly just in the Global Voices community, and now there are over 500 people who come from NGOs, who come from governments, who are individuals, who come from schools and are teachers. And every single morning, one of the first things I do when I check my email is I approve new subscribers to this mailing list. And so this was this morning when I was approving new subscribers. I belong to a young organization called Kampala Junior Team, I assume this is in Uganda, and our interest is to teach young street kids and slum children computer skills and other talents, as well as learn how to blog. So when Rising Voices first started, we were pretty much the only one that in an international context was doing citizen media outreach. We're teaching people how to blog. In those past 18 months, I have met so many different people from NGOs from all over the world. Whenever I go anywhere, the first thing they ask me is, how do we teach more people? Citizen media training is in really high demand right now. Rising Voices has become in high demand as a consultancy, which we're not, but people want us to be their consultant to teach them how to blog because everyone needs a voice. Now it's understood, and it wasn't. Now I'm trying to think of, I think we're at a transition time for Rising Voices. It was funded by a Knight News Challenge grant, which wanted to fund the first 2 years of Rising Voices to get it off its ground to see, is this a good model? It's kind of funding and experimentation. And it has proven to be a good model. Another example of just how much citizen media has kind of gone from this very small thing, mostly based in Western Europe and the United States, to all over is in Uganda, they actually have a citizen media and ICT mailing list where they actually discuss, you know, where is the best place to do workshops. I mean, they're happening all over the place. So now I'm trying to think, is Rising Voices best suited? Can it fulfill its mission the best of teaching underrepresented communities how to become represented online by focusing on 15 or 20 or 25 projects and giving them as many resources as possible? Or are we kind of getting in the way of the other 500, 1,000, 10,000 institutions, organizations, and activists who want to be involved in this but feel like because they don't win the micro grant or because they're not the ones who are featured on Rising Voices that they're somehow not part of the mainstream or that they're not involved to the degree that they would like to be? Another example is just this morning, I was looking at Global Voices. I was doing some reading. Here is a young teacher who's in Iran. He's in one of the most isolated fishing villages in Iran, and he has a school of 4 students. It was actually, after he started this blogging project, it was named by UNESCO as the smallest school in the entire world. And he started a blog, and he taught his students how to blog, and they're the ones who are talking about their little fishing village. And so you can even find out what the issues are of the most isolated fishing village in Iran. But we're not featuring him on Rising Voices. We haven't introduced him to other people, other teachers who are also teaching their, 9-year-old, 10-year-old students how to blog. There are lots of chances for interaction among people and sharing the best practices and learning from each other that's not taking place. And part of the reason is because so much of the communication about this is going through me. I'm the real bottleneck. I get dozens of emails every single day saying from someone wanting to organize a conference saying, will you introduce me to blogging projects that exist in Madagascar, to someone who is in Tanzania and wants to learn more, who is a teacher and wants to learn more about how to train their students blogging. And Rising Voices hasn't done a good job of making a system available to everybody where I'm not the bottleneck, where I don't have to answer these emails back and forth. So I'm trying to think of Rising Voices 2.0, and now it becomes conversation time. I can stop talking so much. There's something that I'm starting to notice about all of these, about new social networks that are coming up, is that they're less social and they're more project. So there are a lot of project-based social networks. I was at PopTech last week, and they launched this thing called The Hub, which is just like Friendster and Facebook, I guess, but except instead of having people as the main kind of atomic unit of the social network, it's a project. And I'm wondering if rather than these 16 projects that we're giving resources to, if we should develop a platform for Rising Voices, if this makes sense to you guys, where there could be 5,000 citizen media projects, and people can list what their needs are, and anyone can go and leave advice for them, where categories and tags can be put so you can see who else is doing environmental-related citizen media projects, so that there's a lot less of me doing the introductions, and there's a lot more just kind of serendipity of finding out who else is involved by region, by topic, by amount of funding that they have. What are funders, what are grants that are available to very specific projects? That's the kind of design for a second edition of Rising Voices that I'm trying to think about. Something else that I've been struggling with a lot is we have these grant competitions, and we get a lot of proposals, usually around 150. It's very difficult to read 150 proposals, especially in 1 month period. It's much, much more difficult to read those 150 proposals than Google the people, ask for letters of recommendation, trying to find out which is the best project. I mean, it's sort of, you can filter it, but it's a matter of kind of throwing darts at a map and saying, okay, I think this is going to be the best one. And we have a team, a committee of maybe 6 or 7 people who give a lot of feedback and are involved in this process of finding out what are the best projects. But what if that gets opened up to the entire world? What if everyone can be involved of choosing who gets the funding or who gets the resources, if there's money even involved? I've been pushing this idea of participatory philanthropy recently, where it's not just 5 people who decide which projects get funded, but maybe 50 people, maybe 100 people, maybe 150. There's some challenges with that, and I'd like to discuss them if you guys have any ideas about it. But one example is Idea Blob, where every month they have a $10,000 prize. It is only it's only applicable for U.S. applicants, but basically, everyone puts the proposal down for the month, and then voting happens, advice is given, comments are given. There's one person who's selected as the guest advisor. This week it's Dr. Park, and they, I think, have a little bit more sway in who gets voted in. But this is completely chosen by the community. And I'm wondering if this is possible or if this just leaves too much unknown. And there would be, you can abuse the system, and how do you get people who are firmly committed to it, and what is their motivation for voting for it? Another site that I've been looking at when thinking about this next edition of Rising Voices, thinking about how to try to scale up or how to make it even more effective, is Mobile Active. They have a directory where projects, they split it up between projects and tools and vendors. I think they should probably have a third directory of case studies, but that's pretty much their weblog that they have on the front page. Does that make sense for something like Rising Voices or a citizen media outreach directory where you have projects, people who are doing really cool things with citizen media, and then you have tools that are available to do really cool things with? And those who are doing projects looking for tools or looking for funders can look in those categories. And funders who are looking for projects to fund and tool makers who are looking to improve their tools and seeing how communities are using them can also look in this directory. So I'm trying to think about how to best design a system where I don't get in the way of it and where other people who are doing the administrative tasks don't get in the way, so that anyone who wants to teach blogging can do so. I think that there's so much potential right now in a lot of institutions that have the technical capabilities, including the Berkman Center. I mean, if an outcome of this day was that in addition to a Tuesday luncheon, a weekly thing, for example, maybe there's also a Thursday afternoon outreach type project where 5 Berkman people go to the Brazilian Immigrant Center in Boston or something like that and teach people how to blog, I mean, that would probably be more effective than any other talk that I could do. So I'm wondering, all of this potential that's out there, how can we make it more effective?
David, I want to push you slightly further and make you talk for like 2 minutes more, because I'm wondering if there's one piece of this that maybe isn't obvious to the room here. And you've been sort of emphasizing this very basic idea, which is the importance of people raising their voice, the importance of having representation on Google, of everyone talking to their own community, which I think is really important. One of the other things that you've seen coming out of Rising Voices is people who really haven't had a voice at all figuring out how to write online and then how that's affected local conversations and local media. So I want you to take 2 minutes and tell the story of Dirty Suso.
Okay. Okay. I'm gonna tell the story of Dirty Suso, who was a homeless man in Medellin, Colombia. Before I do that, there were 3 other quick lessons that I've learned in all of this and have really, I think they got brought out during my time in Medellin. I was down there for 2 months at one point and then 3 months. So one of the projects that we have is called IPA Barrio, which is like hyper neighborhood. And it's this community where most of these projects, actually, something I visit a lot of them. And when I go to the major cities where they are close to, I ask for a taxi to go there, usually before I start taking public transportation. And everyone says, no, you don't want to go to that community. So that's how I know that Rising Voices is doing a pretty good job, is when everyone says, don't go to that place. People like you aren't wanted. That's very much how it is in La Loma San Javier, which is where this project is taking place. I've realized that there are 3 big obstacles to participating online. And it was the third obstacle that really surprised me the most. The first is just access to internet. That's something that Rising Voices can't take care of. That's telecommunications companies and policies. The second thing is learning how to use the tools. That's something that I thought was the only thing that Rising Voices is doing. The third thing, I think, is actually the largest obstacle to participation and is the biggest problem with the digital divide, and that's knowing how to tell a story. And that's not just a developing world thing. It's not just a rural thing. It is in our schools. It is my little sister. She's 18 years old. It's her generation. It's knowing how to put together a compelling narrative, because what always happens whenever a workshop is given, whether I give it or whether it's a local blogger in the community, the first question we always get by every single person is, well, what do I talk about? And so when you're working with communities that haven't been paid attention to, that haven't been listened to for a long time, listening to them and saying, I want to hear what you have to say, becomes a radical thing. They have to completely rethink. I mean, it's almost like a family dynamic sitting at the dinner table, and there are those people who are talking, and then there are always the quiet people who are on the corner of the table who don't want to talk. And if everyone at the table just becomes quiet and says, okay, we want to listen to you now, it's a very scary, intimidating thing. You're very much in the spotlight. So a lot of our effort, we usually have about a single day of, you know, here's how you set up a blog on WordPress, and then we've got the next 2 weeks of, here's a good way to tell a story. Here's how you can juxtapose 2 scenes. Here's non-linearity. Here's why people are interested in what you have to say. Dirty Suso, his name's actually Manuel. I'm going to call him Manuel from now on. But he used to be called Dirty Suso. He was a homeless man in Medellin, in San Javier La Loma. And he was the guy, when you are walking down the street and you're going to the bus stop, he's the one who has a big, hefty bag of cans and bottles. He would go around and pick up recyclables. You can make a decent living doing that in Colombia. So he would probably make about, I don't know, 50 cents a day, which he was able, you know, a lot of people also knew him around, so some people would give him some soup, sancocho, which is a type of soup in Colombia. But nobody knew his story at all. everyone knew who he was. He was the most recognized person in this community by far. If you would just say someone, who is someone that everyone knows in San Javier La Loma? If that was your interview question to the community, it would be Manuel. It would be Dirty Suso. No one knew that his family was the wealthiest family in all of San Javier La Loma, and that they dedicated their land, they gave it away to the city, where now the city parish stands, where the school stands, where the playground stands, and where the library stands. Now, what's pretty cool is that the group that we taught how to blog, that we supported, and it was actually the librarian who taught them how to blog, they were library users. They were a group of about 10 to 20 young library users between 16 and 19 years old. And they just thought that the library is a cool place to hang out. It was also a safe place to hang out because 10 years prior, there were lots of bullets flying back and forth on the street. So right after school, they would go there. Their parents would like this. They'd hang out there for 3 hours. They knew that they would be fine. And mostly they would read. They would make these little ceramic figurines. That was another thing that they would do. But then they got an internet connection. And they started thinking, you know, what could we do with this? And the librarian was very passionate about trying to tell local stories from a local perspective. So he asked them, what should we tell a story about? Someone mentioned Dirty Suso. Like, who is this guy? What was this? Why has he been here forever? Why does he smell so bad? Why doesn't he actually have a house? Why does he live down in this kind of ramshackle brick shack? And they told his story. They went to interview him. They brought their cameras down, and they listened to him. And it was pretty cool because not only it was this double dynamic where they weren't being used to having people listen to them, the kids, and Suso definitely was not used to having people listen to him. So he was just ecstatic to be able to tell his story, and they listened to it, and then they became the bridge. They were the ones who put it out there on the internet. They created a video, and they did a really good job telling the story, and that was the breakthrough moment. So before, they would just say, hi, my name is, and I like this song, or I like this color, and they couldn't think of how to tell a story. But once they got to meet Dirty Suso, once they heard what was going on, they told his story, and that's when they got really inspired. Right now, it's not going to work with yours.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
I'm always prepared.
Good. Right now, they are making a house for him. They're laying down the bricks, and it's about three-fourths of the way done. He actually, when it's raining now in Medellin, which happens a lot, he doesn't have a leaky roof anymore. So that was, for me, that was just an amazing moment. And the entire community is behind it now, and a lot of people are helping Suso out. And the community came together around this cause, and it started because of the story. So it's the learning how to tell a good story that leads to those types of things. Are you going to play the movie?
I am playing the movie. I was just going to play it in the background with the subtitles, but now I'm screwing up because things are like that. But
did that answer
that? I think it answered. I mean, just the point that I wanted to illustrate is that there's a sense in which this all sort of feels like a feel-good project, and like, you know, yeah, it's great, you found a couple of kids in Medellin, Colombia, who get to raise their voice. One of the interesting things that I would argue out of all of this is that in some cases these kids are the next generation of journalists, and that the sort of journalistic work that these kids ended up doing, which ended up in the newspaper, which ended up turning them into community organizers, which ended up with these kids in the library now hanging out and literally building a house for this guy, that it's sort of an interesting example of transformative media. We tend to use the term transformative media around here for you take something, you screw around with its copyright, you mix it, you mash it up. And this is sort of a different space in it, which is essentially saying give people the ability to talk, and their lives are sometimes transformed in really profound ways. So that's what I was hoping to pull out from it. And there are a lot of stories sort of around this. But there's this sort of assumption in the way that you talk about this stuff and that I sort of talk about this stuff, which is that simply giving someone a voice is a worthwhile and important thing to do. And I just think it's a useful assumption to sort of call out and maybe demonstrate sort of where it goes. But now that you and I have both been talking for this entire time, why don't we actually let someone else talk? And my fault, not yours. Questions for David, questions about blogging around the world, questions about outreach.
About absolutely anything, too. I mean, as long as it doesn't have to do with Sarah Palin directly, I'm happy to talk about absolutely anything.
Biggest one, in your opinion? Is it that just it's expanding so fast, or that there are that many internet chat rooms, or like what's your experience of it?
Internet access as far as actual internet connections?
Yeah.
I think just because it's difficult to do that. I mean, I think I would get into telecommunications companies and investments. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in Africa next year, because there are two very big projects taking place right now of getting a lot more internet access in Africa. There's the other 3 billion. Is that what it's? Does anyone know that? Mm-hmm. Where's Google? O3B. Google invested some money to get low-flying satellites going around the southern hemisphere. And so that's going to put in a lot of new internet connections in Latin America and Africa. And then there's also a new fiber optic pipeline that's getting laid around the coast of Africa. So I think we're going to see a lot more connectivity in 2 years. But what's going to happen with all of that connectivity? So I guess I agree with you. Internet access is a huge challenge. And out in the field, it's the biggest challenge, because so many of these websites now, these Web 2.0 websites, have a lot of JavaScript in them. And on a very slow connection, you just have to reload and reload and reload, and it takes hours, which translates into a lot of money, and then the money gets wasted. But what would be your strategy to, how would you deal with that?
Well, actually, I wasn't necessarily asking about, I was just curious what your experience has been in terms of how many of the kids that you're working with that may not have blogged before, how many of them are able to access the internet fairly easily? I mean, know how to use the basic tools, so that you're not teaching them this is Windows, this is the internet, but that they can just start blogging and learning.
I think the biggest determination of a successful project on Rising Voices, the ones that have really been successful, are places where the groups have their own place, mm-hmm. where they can go use the internet when they want, and they can all be together, and they can make it a social atmosphere. So a lot of them do use the internet at institutions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's meeting at cyber cafes. But obviously, when we look at the proposals that they send in, we have to select proposals that have good internet access. Otherwise, it's just not going to be a project that'll work. And we're trying to take a certain amount of resources and then do something, make it into what is more effective, I guess.
So you get about 150 applications. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of criteria you used in selecting what you think will be successful?
Yeah, well, one of the main criteria is what's an underrepresented community, which isn't a very easy thing to define, because underrepresented according to who? So we have one project that's based in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and all of the bloggers who are Bangladeshi are based in Dhaka, Bangladesh, so it doesn't seem like very underrepresented, but they're women. And prior to their project, there were not a lot of female Bangladeshi bloggers, or very, very few. That's one thing. As far as how it will be successful, I mean, it's evolved, and I've learned a lot over the past year and a half. And one of the things that I've learned is that they need their own place. As I was saying before, that's really, if they have that, and if there's one, and I also, there's a group dynamic. So when you have a group that there's a cheerleader, someone who leaves a lot of comments and is very encouraging, that is a very important person to have. If you have someone who is very well organized and does the accounting and does all of the books, and that's really good. And then someone who is just a dynamic trainer who gets people, who can stand up in front and say, this is how you do a blog and this is why you do a blog, and can tell inspiring stories about it. If those three people exist in a project and apply together rather than just having a single individual, it's a good recipe for success.
Colin?
Combining those two questions, what have you learned, or how do you think about the online versus offline? In other words, if these kids in this community, Medine, a lot of the potential audience is folks in that community that they perhaps would like to reach, or folks in that community, but most of them either don't have internet access or don't really care about it, or not heavy users. Maybe they have mobile phones. Maybe there are some existing newspapers, other kinds of fora. It seems like one of the sad things would be to create this great film and then not be able to get it to the people who you most want to reach. And so that we appreciate it sitting here, we say, well, that's powerful, transformative, but at the same time, you want them to be sharing their story and the transformative feel of becoming creators and all these other things in their community. So how have you seen that be successful, or what do you look for, or are there lessons that you've learned, or are you still looking for those lessons, or can you make my comment, my question more intelligent and then answer that?
I think you said it all right there. So I will just repeat it, basically, with my experience in Medellin is actually a good case study. One of my big concerns, because Rising Voices came out about us having a lot of content from big cities in the developing world, but not from outside and not from these underrepresented communities. So we were the ones to benefit. You know, we get more news about the rest of the world. But what about the communities themselves? That was my biggest concern, is that we would benefit, they would just do all of the work, basically. In Medellin, while I was there visiting, they organized a movie night, basically. YouTube on the wall. So we all went into this big church, their only church that's there, and all of the kids, and they have all of their own individual talents besides just video blogging or blogging. One of them is a tremendous rapper and actually has a rap song about blogging where he mentions all of the blog titles of all of his friends. It's a very cool song. And so they did this performance. There's another one who's a really good musician. He's a great trumpet player, so he got his whole band up there. So it was a mix of all of this live performances because they're just really talented youth. And then they would get the projector and shine it up on the wall of the church and show all of their movies. Now, for the people living in San Javier La Loma, it sounds funny for us because this is, you know, putting YouTube crap up on a wall. And it's not crap. I mean, the stories that they did were really well, but we think about dogs on skateboards. And for them to see, I mean, there's just this metaphor with television. So anything that's video is TV. So all of a sudden they're on TV and they're famous because they're on TV. So to go through some of these slides and you would see certain characters from the community come online, everybody would just start laughing or clapping. It was like going to a movie back when I was a kid and people were actually excited about movies and it felt like a big thing to do. So that was a lot of fun. And I think that we need to encourage a lot more of that. And I think that we should probably specify when we talk about things that should be used from this microgrant funding, that that's a good stuff to do, that you want a lot of the media to be played in the local community and not just to be shipped outside to the international internet.
Roxy, you had a question?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about language barriers and just how whether it's written in English or written in the native languages is relevant to connecting one community?
It's big, and I think that there's probably some bias in the projects that we've chosen in that we have a lot of people who speak the languages that the communities speak, that the projects that we've chosen. So we have
Malagasy
is a great example. I mean, we have a huge Malagasy translation community on Global Voices. We must be like the number one content producer of Malagasy text out there. And so we have a outreach project in Madagascar that's done amazingly well. Probably for some languages where you only have just a few speakers, it would be great to... another example, actually, is in Bolivia. We have a couple Aymara translators there who can translate from Spanish to Aymara, and then we have a couple others who translate from Spanish to English. So we get a lot of the things that are written in Spanish into Aymara, things that are written into Aymara into Spanish and then English. It also goes back to the question about the internet. You know, why isn't that a big priority to actually get internet access first? And I think it's looking at what we have and seeing how we can be most effective with what we have. And so language is a big deal. Right now, we're taking on we just gave funding to a couple of projects, one that's in Ukraine and one that's in Russia. I don't speak Russian, and so I'm very dependent on a friend of mine, a colleague at Global Voices, Veronica. We email each other all the time, back and forth now. So I email her, she emails the two project leaders, and she's the bridge between. That's how it works.
Rob?
I just want to make a comment on that. I think that, you know, the layout of the internet is certainly not only a supply phenomenon, but a demand phenomenon. I think the notion of demonstrating the power of the internet in order to foster demand is a great strategy. I think people talk about supply entirely too much. That was my comment. The question, what is it that people are writing about, and how does that compare to your preconceptions about what people were going to be writing about? And I guess it's a two-part question. How much of this goes towards the kind of the core political events in communities? I mean, poor communities are often most ravaged by mismanagement, poor governance, corruption, all those kinds of things. Are people talking about that, or are they talking more about life and celebration and other parts of things?
Much more about life and celebration, especially at the beginning, which I think is good, because you want to enjoy blogging, I think, in citizen media. I think is an important thing to make it not feel like a chore. One of the difficulties of bringing up mismanagement and corruption is that these communities that we're working in are very small. And so when I see a group of 20 bloggers, and then I go into the community, I find out that that's 1/8 of the community right there. Everyone knows everyone else. And before I even get there, everyone knows who I am, and there's a lot of talking. So there's a lot of self-censorship in not wanting to offend people. But we've also seen there's been a lot of unrest recently in Bolivia. In fact, if you go to the Rising Voices blog right now, the latest post, will be about how those bloggers view the unrest and what they think about some of the referendums for autonomy that have been happening lately. And so when something major does happen, and especially if they see other people reporting it in a way that they don't think is a good reflection of how they see it, then they will definitely write about it. And that happened in Bolivia.
I think just wanted to sort of add on that, right? Kenya has probably the most dynamic blogosphere pound for pound of any African nation right now. Probably not as many bloggers as South Africa, but arguably better and higher quality bloggers. Most of the time, they aren't especially political. There's a lot of, here's what's going on in life. Probably the best blogger in the country blogs about the stock market, and is sort of phenomenal as a bank insider. When there was political strife at the end of December and through January and February of this past year, every one of these guys switched over to becoming political reporters. And so one of the interesting questions on all of this is, to what extent is this sort of learning how to use the tools, learning how to have a space, and then being ready for that moment where there is some sort of emergency, and then having the ability to sort of amplify out of that? And it's a weird sort of long-term strategy, right? I mean, the sort of the mark that we're sort of shooting for is, let's get the voice of the community out there. And the truth is, most of the time, you may not care about the voice of the community. It's probably a more internally focused thing. It may be stories like the story about Manuel and getting people in the community involved with something. But if that community starts having a set of issues that are globally interesting or nationally interesting, you suddenly have a set of people who are capable of communicating about them on a global or a national scale.
And when you look at it in aggregate, when you subscribe to the comment feeds of all of these blogs, then every day there are at least 5 comments, someone saying, oh my God, you know, I used to live in that community when I was 5 years old. I thought nobody else in the world even knew about it. This is so amazing that I can see it. So it's relevant to some people. It's probably not that relevant to us, what's happening in some very small little village in some country. But that's the internet, you know? It's lots of small little groups, and what's relevant to you isn't relevant to someone else. I'm really interested. I don't know if you guys have talked about this before, but I'm really interested in knowing. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that Rising Voices has been successful, I've talked about this, is the sense of community that we have. And in Rising Voices proper, people who are really working on it actively, we're probably right around 150 people, which is this kind of Dunbar's number that they talk about, where you can have a community up to 150 people, and then when you have more of that, it's no longer a community because it's too big, and people start forgetting each other's names. They don't care about each other. It's more like this just big organization. And so I have this huge feeling of hesitation. I have this one feeling of saying, wow, Rising Voices has done so great. I'm so ready to scale this up. I want this to be big. I want us to work with so many institutions. We have so many opportunities right now. We finally met the right people. And then I go back to our mailing list, and we're joking around, and there's so much familiarity, and I'm thinking, I don't want to lose this. Has anyone in here been involved in some social network that has successfully scaled up and kept like a good feeling of cohesiveness and of mission after 150? Or is that just how it goes? Is it just fizzle away?
I don't know if that's not helpful or not.
There's something to be learned from.
So we tried to create a social networking site for people that were doing digital storytelling for community activism purposes, and doing based off of a conference that was sort of pulled together by a bunch of different sources. And the outcome of the end of that conference was, we need to keep this conversation going, so let's build a website. And so that was a major project of mine for a year, and it sort of stalled. And I think, and it goes back to the question you were asking around, you know, the bottleneck. So I think for us, the bottleneck was there was one organization that was doing the main training, but then it was also people were sort of going off and becoming individual facilitators that would get really embedded in what they were doing, or there were community activists who didn't have time beyond social networks and didn't have this history of being on Facebook or using those tools. And so we've been sort of struggling to the point now that we've tried to form an advisory board, and we had a meeting, and half the people on this phone call had never actually been on the site, but were just interested in the topic and in the field. And that was sort of strong for me, because I think what was missing from that was what you're saying about the social appeal. And then I feel, and we keep going back to saying, we need to have another conference, we need to have a physical meeting of people, because these are all people, and I'm assuming, like, if you're talking globally, that the connections are hard, there might be some language barriers and that sort of stuff, but we still need that social feel. And the reason why you're the bottleneck is because they know you. And there's some value in the recommendations that you
give of, do you know this person, do you know this person? And so I'm not sure, like, that's we weren't successful. I think we weren't successful because we weren't built on this very already strong network. Things like Facebook, I think, are strong because they start from, I know this person in person, this is my brother, and then he knows all these people.
Right.
So how do you build off of that instead of just having a really great tool?
I mean, I think conferences are a really good way to do it. You get people together. Very expensive way to do it.
Yeah.
We got people together and we danced to Bollywood movies, which is like the best thing you can do for community building.
Unfortunately, we're still paying it off.
Exactly.
Which, no, is legitimate. One thing that definitely works on this is that some hybrid between online and face-to-face is incredibly important. And that's actually one of the interesting things in Rising, right, is that you guys have these offline groups that are getting together. They're interacting online. The hope is that if everyone has a sense for this online, offline, that they'll be better about interacting with one another. And it seems to have more of a rhythm than pure offline groups. One of the ways that GV in general has worked is by working offline for 12 to 18 months at a time, getting together offline for 5 or 6 days at enormous expense, and sort of hoping that the social glue that comes out of that will last for another 12 to 18 months, sort of coming from it. None of which addresses the 150 people problem. I want to see if I can put Esther on the spot and ask a question sort of relating to your work, which is, you've got this understandable, justifiable, and fascinating skepticism about young people's ability and willingness, in some cases, to sort of pick up these tools and use them as creators. And you've done a great job sort of documenting participation gaps and such. There's a sense in which I think David's trying to challenge that and is essentially saying that if you find a sufficiently motivated group of people in almost any corner of the world, even if they're in rural Madagascar, they'll find themselves producing videos and having them subtitled and spreading them around the web. Is there a contradiction between those stances? Is this the sort of extraordinary special case, or is it the sort of hand-holding that David and his communities are doing, or is this a challenge to some of your concerns about participation gaps? This is Harvard.
No,
we're allowed to be very difficult. Yeah.
Part of me would rather just address the 150 and scaling up. I was actually going to
talk about
something else. But, I mean, and I haven't done research on this. This is more anecdotal. But I wouldn't be surprised if part of it is that initially you put stuff up, but if you don't have an audience, I mean, that's a research question, but are you going to keep putting it up? And that's why one would want to cultivate a community where you have an automatic audience. And so I've been thinking about Crooked Timber, which is this academic group blog, and I was going to bring that up as something that managed to go past 150, but it's not clear quite. So we've sort of, it's an academic group blog. There are 15 contributors, of which about 6 or 7 actually contribute regularly. And there are thousands of readers, but I don't know, a few dozen who are commenting all the time. And one of the nice parts about the community is that even though there are only 15 people who can post, the commenters can very easily sort of hijack a thread and make it whatever they want it to be, and that's kind of fine if others feel that's fine. And I think we've had a problem scaling up, but we're still okay because we haven't become too popular. I think once you get into the 10, 20, 30,000, then just forget it. And we're small enough that we can still keep an eye on the comments, and if people become completely ridiculous, and when I say that, like, very explicitly racist or anti-Semitic, we'll warn them or get rid of them as much as we can. So I think there is a threshold, although I would think it's above 150, so, and I don't know if you just, that's not the actual number, or, and it depends on the kind of community, but I would think that you can go beyond that and still.
Is part of it with Crooked Timber that they are all academics?
Well, actually, so I should clarify, they're not actually all academics, and many of the readers are not at all. And within academia, it's several fields, and a lot of the blogging has nothing to do with academia, it's politics. It's partly what you said, that it's anything, so we don't have that every post has to be so serious that you're freaking out about how serious is it going to be, and then it sort of all dies.
But no, I mean, it's a varied enough community. I'm actually surprised it's gone on as well as it has in some ways, because I don't think you could necessarily predict it. But to get back to Ethan's question about the work, I mean, I think I have to think about this more. I think it's a really difficult one. I'm not even gonna try to say anything.
Okay.
Sorry.
I will suggest that you guys talk about it at some point, because it's a question that you're both passionate about. Yes.
How much sort of cross-pollination you get among the communities. Do you have the people in Colombia reading the South African blogs and commenting and messaging each other?
They're translating. So, for example, there are three people who kind of started and are keeping this Madagascar project going. And they are translating the blog. So a blog post from the Columbia group will get translated into English, and then they will translate it into Malagasy. And there is some cross-pollination. I also encourage, when I visit the projects, I always ask them to do these video messages to the other groups. And so they send video messages. And it took a while for that cross-pollination to happen. And it's still mostly happening within languages. So the Columbia group and the Bolivia group do read their blogs a lot. But it just takes a lot of work to do it across languages.
Yeah, that's
brilliant. Yeah.
It is probably the biggest net problem that no one talks about, is human language. And it's the sort of thing that you don't bump into until you actually try to do something like this, and you discover that no matter how much work you're doing, that any time you try to deal with those sort of like Metcalf network effects, that if you need a translator to make each one of those connections, that all of those sort of network effects that you're used to suddenly become much, much harder. Josh?
I've also had experience with the difficulty of getting kind of transnational groups to do something together. So my question is, I'm wondering if the glue of the smaller group that you're talking about is sufficiently strong such that it can produce what's needed for this larger audience. You know, you're talking about creating a tool or whatever it is, a means for reaching this larger audience. Perhaps you can strengthen the smaller group that you have by having them collectively work on something that will allow you to crowdsource all the things you just talked about.
Yeah.
What about that?
That's been one of our strategies, is to have a monthly blog carnival where they all blog about the same topic. But it hasn't been too successful, because I've just found that when you tell people, you guys should blog about this, that's not what they want to blog about. They, you know, and blogging is one of those things that when you're inspired, you're inspired, and you start writing down. When you are given an assignment, it feels like a homework assignment. So I don't know if there are other strategies besides trying to get everyone to blog about the same thing. I wonder if there are any lessons from Wikipedia, because Wikipedia has a huge user base. And don't they have some kind of, not a hazing ritual, but like a way to get you, you know, indoctrinated into the Wikipedian sphere?
Before the branding?
I was thinking less on the kind of group messaging, but more on creating the resources. And maybe that's even a harder step than getting people to talk about the same thing. But, you know, is that an opportunity? Or is it such that, you know, the net time is so limited and getting them to just produce content is so limited that these other things would be not yet appropriate?
It is pretty tough. I mean, these are volunteer projects. The people who are running them, if they're given anything, it's like $200, you know, to do what they do. And then there are volunteers who are doing the blogging, too, and they have their jobs or they're in school. So it's hard to know how much more you can ask for.
Last question.
I have a question about the audience ID. So what kind of perception of the audience do you find with these bloggers when they start, and how does that change? Is it something like, do they have the idea of talking to the whole world, or do they have the idea of actually talking to the community, or do they feel at some point that they're talking into space, or do they stalk? Like, can you say something about that, and how that is also maybe culturally very different between the different places where you work?
I think they start out knowing that they're talking to the world, because they're involved in this project, and the person who applies for the grant will say, you know, this is part of an international project. You'll have people reading you from all over the world. They're very excited about that. It takes more time to foster the local connections and foster local readers, because they're just not used to it. So when you don't have any content out there, you have nothing to read. Once the content's out there, then you need to start saying, hey, there's all of this stuff there. You should go read it if you live in this area. Or, you know, having a YouTube video night like we were talking about before. But I think it's those local connections that keep the bloggers going more, because they feel like they're connected to someone, that they have someone who knows what they're writing about intimately.
Do you provide them with statistics?
That's something that we've done a pretty bad job with. That's something that we should be doing a much better job with, to let them know who's reading.
We're going to close the formal conversation here, but please, David's going to be sticking around for a while. Please come ask him more questions. For those of you interested in this, it's rising.globalvoicesonline.org. Thanks to everyone for being part of it, and many thanks to David Sasaki.
Thank you.